It's United States versus Ross. Ms. Johnson.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Tiffany Johnson, and I'm representing Mr. Cleo Ross. Uttering magic words does not support an otherwise incorrect legal analysis. I would suggest in this case that when Defendant Ross requested to have the district court judge rule on his request to admit polygraph evidence, the judge did state some magic words in his analysis. He indicated that he knew that he should do a Rule 403 analysis, a balancing test between the probative value of the test and the prejudicial effect. However, he then went on to talk about his state court experience, his experience in the state of Illinois, which has a blanket exclusion on admitting polygraph evidence. And what I am suggesting to this court, arguing to this court, is that, in fact, the ruling was made based upon the district court's experience in Illinois and their blanket exclusion regarding the admission of polygraph evidence.
This was a privately arranged polygraph.
Yes, Your Honor.
Without notice to the other side. Do you know any court that's admitted polygraph evidence like that?
No, Your Honor.
And the reason is, if the polygraph test is negative, it never sees the light of day, isn't that right?
Your Honor, actually,
when you take it, right, as you know, it's
got nothing to lose, right?
That's true. You don't have anything to lose, Your Honor. However, there has been this court did reference a study done where it indicated that the fact that it was a one-sided test did not affect the validity of the results, and so refused to take the stance that simply because it was a one-sided test that the results were invalid, specifically for that reason. And I would suggest to you that there is no blanket exclusion of polygraph tests simply because they're one-sided. There still needs to be the proper balancing test or the proper balancing procedure done by the district court.
No, there should be. Otherwise, you're shifting the balance in favor of the defendant. No reason to do that because there's some error rate, obviously, probably pretty high with lie detector tests. And this means that whenever there's an error in favor of the defendant, he uses the evidence, right? In all other cases, he doesn't.
That would be true, Your Honor. I can't imagine.
The government never gets a crack at an inaccurate lie detector test, only the defendant. So why would the law shift the balance that way?
Well, Your Honor, it's not so much that I'm arguing that the law should shift the balance that way. If that were the rationale that was utilized by the district court judge in assessing the circumstances regarding admission for this particular polygraph, then my argument, I would suggest, would be a lot weaker. But in the case at hand, that was not the rationale that was used by the district court judge. The rationale that was used by the district court judge was that there's a blanket exclusion in Illinois, in the Illinois state courts, and even further into the proceedings when we move to sentencing, there's language from the judge that he considers it to be ineffective assistance of counsel simply to even seek to admit the polygraph test. And I would suggest that that's just not the correct analysis that should have been utilized in making a determination as to whether the test should have been admitted in this case. Had the proper balancing test been used, where the judge compared the probative value of the test to the prejudicial effects of the test to the government, addressed the potential confusion of the issues, and the possibilities for misleading the jury and undue delay, if the judge had done that in analyzing whether this test should be admitted, then we'd have a different situation here. It's my argument that he did not do that, and that was problematic, similar to what was determined to be problematic in McMorris, where the judge excluded the polygraph examination results simply because of the prosecutor's blanket veto on allowing in such results. The judge has to utilize the proper analysis in determining the admissibility of evidence, and in this case, I'm arguing that he did not. And when you combine that with the ruling that was made in connection with allowing the prior conviction for home invasion against Mr. Ross, should he choose to testify, there was cumulative error in this case that should require a remand. I acknowledge right off the bat that that is a difficult argument, considering that the defendant did not choose to testify, and there is precedent, Supreme Court precedent, that says when the defendant doesn't testify, he waives his right to make this argument. However, the analysis that was utilized in Luce and Burrell, I would suggest, had to do with Rule 609 and with the defendant asserting a constitutional right to testify, whereas I'm requesting that this court make a ruling on this issue in connection with Rule 403 and the judge misapplying or making the inaccurate assessment that the probative value of this conviction, this home invasion conviction, outweighed its prejudicial effect. The facts of the case at hand involved an individual accused of committing a home invasion in order to enter into a residence, and where a gun was later found with his fingerprint, and he was then accused as being a felon in possession of a firearm. His home invasion conviction was simply too similar to the facts of the case at hand for it to be properly admitted against him should he decide to testify. And I would suggest that this court needs to have a mechanism aside from requiring that the defendant make the problematic choice between remaining silent on the remote chance that he might win on appeal, there should be a mechanism that this court can utilize to determine when a prior conviction is improperly admitted against a defendant, or is has been made, or when a ruling has been made that the prior conviction will be improperly admitted if the defendant chooses to testify. And
yeah,
right,
but then
now
he gets two bites at the apple, right?
Well,
he testifies, loses, then appeals, saying he was forced to testify, you know, violated the Fifth Amendment right because of this extraneous evidence. So, I mean, we just had an opinion a couple of weeks ago which said, following the Supreme Court decisions, obviously, that we don't permit that.
Yes, Your Honor. And I just would argue that there needs to be some type of mechanism.
I don't know why.
Because otherwise, how will district court judges know whether they're making the right decisions.
If the district judge is wrong and violates 403 or what have you, then defendant has an appellate remedy. He doesn't have to testify.
And I am suggesting, Your Honor, that the only appellate remedy that will assist defendants is if this court, in fact, issues a ruling indicating that admitting the prior conviction was erroneous. And without that, there's no guidance for the district court regarding the admissions of these prior convictions. I mean, the reality is that in a case where the facts involve home invasion, defendants are never going to testify if the judge makes a ruling to allow a prior home invasion conviction.
That's just a request that we disagree with the Supreme Court's holding of Luce, and we're not in that business.
If the court has no further questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Mr. Bass?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Timothy Bass on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, as noted in the defendant's reply brief, the opening issue in this appeal has been conceded, which leaves the three issues of the polygraph.
I don't understand the concession, I have to say. I thought that was the most interesting and difficult issue. Because after all, the crime was committed years before the honor about date in the indictment. So if it means that if there's any control over if there's any sense that, you know, the grand jury really has to have considered the most significant facts of the charge, this violates that, doesn't it?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, but keep in mind that this issue developed.
The honor about embrace 4 years.
4 or 5.
Well, the date of the offense could have began sometime prior to the date of the indictment, but there certainly was evidence.
But it didn't continue that long because the shotgun had been out of his possession for a long time. Unless you think, you know, felon in possession means once he possesses it, he possesses it forever. I mean, clearly you can relinquish possession.
Correct, Your Honor. But frankly, the it was the government's intent in indicting this case, and certainly up until the time the trial started, was to argue that the date of the offense was a date reasonably close to September the 8th, and that whatever date the offense...
But it wasn't.
Well, it was, Your Honor, and the reason was because there was evidence that we presented to establish that the defendant was given access to this residence, and he continued to have access to the residence by virtue of his key. So
access to the residence does not mean you possess the property in the residence. I mean, that's ridiculous. That's absurd, right? That's like saying, well, I stayed in a hotel. It means I possessed all the furniture in the hotel. In the room, in the hotel, right?
Well,
that's ridiculous.
Let me ask this question a different way. Suppose the indictment had said, we, the grand jury, charge the defendant with possessing a firearm at any period during the 5 years before this indictment. Period. That's all it said. Didn't name the firearm, didn't name the time. Would that be a valid indictment? No, right? It would be a transparently invalid indictment. But as it was reconstructed in the instructions to the jury, that's all the indictment alleged. That he possessed any old firearm, to be proved later, at any old time within the period of limitations, to be proved later.
Well, Your Honor, the indictment charged that he possessed a firearm on or about September
the 8th. A particular firearm at a particular time.
Well, this... the particular...
If you think the charge, he possessed gun X at time T, means the same thing as he possessed any gun, X or not, at any time, T or not, within the 5 years preceding this indictment, then what you've said is it's perfectly lawful to have a blank indictment. But you don't believe that for a moment. And therefore, the question arises how this jury instruction could be correct. Now, maybe the reply brief is not simply a forfeiture but a waiver. But it is a very serious problem.
Well, I don't know how it could be any more clear.
Do you think the indictment is constraining the instructions? Maybe you don't think they constrain them at all.
Your Honor, I do think that the indictment...
Because that could mean, you know, you have an indictment, and then the government puts in whatever evidence it wants, then the instructions are conformed to the evidence, but the evidence may have no relation to the indictment. That would be a problem, wouldn't it?
It would, Your Honor, but you're... I would suggest that the hypotheticals that the court is suggesting are in no way related to the facts of this case. And the facts of this case are that...
But certainly the instructions permitted the jury to find that the shotgun had been possessed, that Ross possessed the shotgun 4 years ago, 4 years before the date of the indictment, period.
There was, if the record reflects, and I would suggest to Your Honor, that it was the clear intent of the government that the charge and the be limited and the jury be instructed that it had to find that the defendant possessed this particular firearm within a date reasonably close to the indictment.
But is 4 years reasonably close?
Pardon me?
Do you think 4 years is reasonably close?
When the defendant's defense is that he did not possess the gun within the requisite limitations period,
yeah,
the answer to that question is clearly yes.
How that expands the scope of the charge. Your position, and indeed the concession in the reply brief, seems to be that as soon as the defendant says this charge is untimely, I didn't possess a weapon within the statute of limitations, that expands the scope of the charge from whatever is actually in the indictment to any crime you committed within the period of limitations. But that completely takes the indictment out of the picture. It allows a blank indictment. And you haven't risen to my bait by saying that such an indictment would be valid, right? You agree it would not be, right?
I didn't agree to that, Your Honor. I said it may raise...
Such an indictment would be valid?
If the government...
Let me have the position of the United States Department of Justice on the question whether the indictment I named would be valid.
I think it could raise problems of notice, but it would not be per se invalid, Your Honor. Because if an indictment returned by a grand jury said that a defendant within the limitations period possessed a firearm after being convicted of a felony, then the grand jury is charged the essential elements of the offense. That's what this court said in Folks. Now, the further you get into the limitations period...
If that is really the Department of Justice's position, you need to go back to law school and take a course in criminal procedure. That's simply bizarre.
Your Honor, I'm simply restating what this court made very clear in Folks, that any date...
Name me a case in which we have said that an indictment of the sort I described is proper.
I don't have such a case, Your Honor.
There
I have,
is none.
But there is clear language in Folks which says that proof of any date within the limitations period is sufficient. The language in Folks could not be clearer. The language in the Supreme Court case decided in the brief...
Why does the Department of Justice make it its policy to return indictments of this kind? It would avoid all sorts of questions about what the defendant did, when he did it, whether the indictment has been constructively amended. If the indictment is just a blank, of course, you don't need to worry about whether it's been constructively amended.
Your Honor, there's no reason to do that. And as I said, I agree that it would be problematic for the government not to seek indictments that alleged particular facts and alleged dates to give the defendant notice. He has a right to have some type of notice, and that's why I said it would be problematic. But the circumstances of this case were that we went into this trial prepared to prove that the offense was committed on or about September the 8th. That
yes,
the date of
the,
possession.
But the jury was permitted to find that it occurred on May 22nd, 1998.
Because the defendant raised a statute of limitations defense and was asserting that defense over and over throughout the trial, Your Honor. And Judge McCuskey found during the instruction conference that given giving the reasonably...
So you're saying that if the defendant tries to show that the facts are different from alleged in the indictment, he waives any objection to the... I don't understand you. Suppose he'd said, yes, I possessed the gun, but it was in 1950. Would you be able to say, well, the jury should be instructed to find whether he possessed it in 1950?
I think under the law for a felon in possession, that it would be appropriate for the government to prove and for a jury to find that the defendant possessed a firearm after being convicted of a felony within any date within the requisite limitations period. That's all we ask the jury to find in this case. That's clearly what this court has said in full.
So when an indictment specifies a date, that's to be understood as extending back in time the period of the limitations? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. That it is put, that where the date of the offense is not an element, that where the indictment uses broad enough language that says on or about, again, going back to this court's decision in Folks,
but all instructions on on or about say reasonably close
on
to
or about,
don't they? Isn't that the standard jury instruction on an on or about indictment?
It is, Your Honor, and because the facts in every case, in my experience, have not had this issue raised. We didn't know the exact date when the defendant began possessing the firearm. But unlike Judge Posner's hypothetical of a motel room, if I'm living at a house and my things are at a house and I happen to move
out,
but I retain
the jury could have been asked, you know, whether on or about September 8th, 2002, Ross possessed this shotgun. But obviously you weren't comfortable with that. You wanted to push it back to a much earlier date, and so you allowed the, and you, so you drafted an instruction which said on May 22nd, 1998. So what you're arguing is if the facts don't support the indictment but support some other offense, some other set of facts, the jury can be so instructed. You don't have to go back to the grand jury. That's your argument.
That's not my argument, Your Honor, because charging a different... your question presupposes that we were charging a different offense, which means that the date of the offense was an element, which it clearly was not. Now,
it has to be in the indictment for some reason, right? You have to have a date in an indictment, don't you, or don't you? Maybe you don't. Maybe just say within the statute... Just say an indictment within the statute of limitations, the defendant possessed a firearm. Would that suffice?
I think that would be problematic, Your Honor.
That's, of course, what your argument comes down to, right? The date September 8th actually meant the statutory period.
Well, there are issues of prejudicial variance, unlike a constructive amendment of the indictment, which would be reversible. Prejudicial variance could be reversible if...
There's a five-year statute of limitations?
There is a five-year statute of limitations.
So that's basically your argument.
If there are no problems...
The date in the indictment is that date and up to five years before.
If there are no problems with notice or prejudicial variance, then such an indictment could be valid. Yes, Your Honor.
No problems with notice.
Well,
the grand jury is supposed to consider the various facts, right? Maybe they don't like stale cases.
Well, the grand jury is not called upon to render a finding as to the specific date when an offense occurred and when it ended.
Well, it's supposed to sign this grand jury.
The grand jury alleged that the defendant...
So the date is irrelevant because the grand jury isn't interested in it. Is that your point?
No, Your Honor, that's not what I'm suggesting. Under the facts of this case, all that happened was we tendered a reasonably close instruction before the trial.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Then during the trial, it became clear, beginning with this polygraph, to try to argue to the jury that the defendant possessed this gun 10 years before the facts of the offense. And then the arguments by counsel throughout the trial that he possessed the gun. She ended up conceding that the defendant possessed the gun at some point in time, but just not within the 5 years.
What now, if it wasn't a gun but a bomb?
Your Honor, if the date of the offense, and under your hypothetical, I don't think the date of the offense in that hypothetical would be an element either.
I'm not talking about dates. What if the indictment says a firearm, but the proof and the instructions were that it was a bomb? Would that make a difference to you?
Yes.
Why?
Because it's charging a different offense.
Well, they're in the same statute, aren't they?
Yeah. It's all the same statute.
No, the statute here was prohibiting a felon from possessing any firearm or ammunition.
Right. There's no firearm, it's ammunition that's proved. Does that make a difference?
Yes, it would, because the indictment didn't allege ammunition. It alleged a firearm.
It didn't allege May 22nd, 1998.
No, it didn't. The firearm was an element.
One of the reasons why you put a date in the indictment is so that you can assert it as a double jeopardy offense if you're acquitted. I believe that's correct, isn't it? So if in this case you'd stuck to the original indictment, the original charge that was committed on or about this day, and he took the stand, let's say the judge kept out his home entry conviction or whatever, he took the stand and said, no, I had this gun and I toted it around 4 years ago, but I didn't have it at this time, and he was acquitted. Could you then recharge him with the offense that he admitted on the stand that he committed 4 years earlier, assuming the statute of limitations hadn't run?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. If there was a continuing possession of the firearm,
well,
it's possible to have
continuing possession in that hypothetical.
Well, if the offense charged was one thing and he was acquitted of that charge and he admitted to a different offense, then yes, he could be charged with that different offense.
I mean, if he's charged with robbing a bank in 02 and he gets on the stand and said, I robbed that bank, but I did it 3 years earlier, what do you do? He's acquitted on the 02 charge. You can charge him again with what he admitted, right? Because
he's
been a double jeopardy bar.
He's been acquitted of
the 02, but not the one he admitted.
He's been acquitted of robbing that bank, regardless of the date that it was alleged. And, Your Honor, I'm not prepared to say that in any number of hypotheticals that it's okay for the government to charge an offense with no date and within any period within the limitations period. All I'm suggesting to you here in this case, and again, this is waived in the reply brief, is that what happened was that
we understand your argument. Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Johnson, does she have any time? 4 minutes? Why on earth did you waive your best argument?
It's funny, I was asking myself that exact question. Well, I believe I bought into the concept of
Well, that was a rhetorical question. I don't want you to start arguing the other side. Okay?
Which is a bit problematic, to say the least. At this point, Your Honor, I'm somewhat in a position where I would just request that if you have any more questions for me, I believe that I fully argued the initial parts of my brief and don't have anything further to offer to the court regarding those two issues.
Okay.
So if you have any further questions to ask of me, then
yes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And you were, and we, well, we thank the defenders for handling the case. Okay, next case for argument is